back to school being appropriate, as many of our clients are seeing their children head back to college, for example, what planning should be put in place. So once a child turns 18, that child in the tri-state area is an emancipated individual. By that, it means that that child has constitutionally protected rights. These go back to the founding of the Constitution and what our forefathers put in place. That's good news and bad news. The good news is that that child now has rights that are protected, and that child can make decisions. The bad news is that 200 years ago, a child at 18 had their own farm and had been married for 4 years and had three kids. And our clients now, whose children are far more sophisticated and worldly than they were 200 years ago, may not be as responsible in some areas. And 18 is an arbitrary date, and there can be issues. And even for those that are immensely responsible and mature at 18, there are risks. So once your child turns 18, you no longer can make decisions on behalf of your child. You may, legally that is, you may tell your child, and certainly I pray that when our children, my and my wife's children turn 18, our children will still respect them. We always have the leverage of being under our roof and being financed by us. But in the end, the decisions are theirs. What happens, however, if that child becomes incapacitated? So if they're in a hospital and, for example, they're down at the Jersey Shore out in the Hamptons and they're racing to Southampton Hospital or Jersey Shore Central, and you want that child to get to New York, well, the first set of facts is that since that child is over 18, by law, you don't automatically have that right. And there's a whole series of motives that why that hospital may not want to release that child, including fear of malpractice or the new hospital finding new issues. So that's number one. Number two is suppose there has been the reason the child is hospitalized is because there's been a car accident. They're with friends on a break, you need to get information on behalf of your child, or you need to bring a suit, or you need to find out further details. Once your child is 18, you no longer have that right. You have to go through a much more complex guardianship proceeding, and that requires time. It requires your child typically be represented by separate counsel. It requires a proving process, and then once you succeed, the courts say, okay, congratulations, Mr. McManus, you are the appointed representative for your child, but remember that we're in charge here, and so you need to report back to us and tell us what you're doing on your adult child's behalf, because we are the ultimate protector. So we can hope to minimize or mitigate some of those responsible issues by putting together a couple of things. With the candles and the hat and the happy birthday song, you should present to your child, as we have for so many of our clients, a power of attorney and a healthcare proxy. Those two things are critical because they empower you to act on your child's behalf the same way that you have empowered others to act on your behalf. So once they're 18, they should be signing this health care proxy and power of attorney. Who do they choose? Well, for us, typically we only will put two people, mom and dad. Maybe if there's an adult sibling, you can put that child as well. And really what you want to do is just efficiently get this work done. We think it's critical before they head to college because there's a whole series of issues as well when they leave to go. So number two is when your child leaves for college, and is hurt or is suffering in some manner. Suppose your child is up at school and you're not sure how well they're doing. They left here in the New York metropolitan area for school. Your child seems okay, but you're not sure. The universities will not release any information because they are constitutionally prohibited. Your child is an independent adult. They also like it that way because they don't want the overly indulging helicopter parents getting in the way. More on that in a minute. But you don't have access. As many of you know, you cannot get your child's grades. You cannot get your child's medical records. And look, they're adults. We fully appreciate that. But when we're financing them, or when there is an issue with a medical situation that you're not finding out about that could be critical to their health, and we know of a series of facts where a child, in fact, passed away at school because the university was not watching it closely, the school medical system was involved, but they hadn't posted anybody, and the child's friends were not releasing any information. Well, that child's life could have been saved if the parents had the ability to access medical records and speak with the university on the child's behalf. We believe that it's a fair trade if your child is getting financing from you, that you, for your child's behalf, have the right in an emergency to have access without having to go through the complex legal system. How do we find universities feeling about this interesting paradox when they say that the child is immensely independent and they only want to deal with that child? Well, when we're told that your son is going to be studying at the University of Rome or going to Barcelona for 6 months, you'll find that the universities will have, you know, a massive program involved where the parents are introduced and oriented to what the overseas program is going to mean, and they say, for sure, you must get a power of attorney and healthcare proxy so that you can have access to your child when they're overseas. So that's when the light bulb goes off for many of you and others who have not heard about this up to now to say, well, if I'm doing this because my child is going overseas, what right do I have to get medical records here in the U.S. if something happens when they're up in Boston? And at that point, you find out, oops, did we let that get by you, says the university. Well, yes, you can put together a power of attorney here and a health care document. So key here is before your child leaves for school, we think at the time they turn 18, we want to have those documents in place and we want to be efficient about it. Number three, when your child turns 18, does your child require a will? We broadly believe the answer is no, and there'll be a theme that we'll pass over the course of this discussion today as to why. For the most part, all of you who are on this call will know that we have put planning in place for your children where the assets, once they turn 18, are going to be in trust for them. So there is nominal risk, comparatively speaking, that, one, it's designed to protect them from themselves and from others, but additionally, they don't really have assets in their name. If they pass away, there are a series of eventualities that are provided for in the succession of the trust. So the child doesn't have assets. But sometimes the child will get a block of money from grandparents because it was in a custodial account, or they'll be entitled to some chunk of money under a trust that was prepared not by our firm. We would not recommend that. But now the child has those assets. In that instance, yes, to put a will together. The last piece is sometimes we'll build in a will to say that the child has a trust, and then on the child's death it will go to be divided among the child's siblings or the child's spouse or charity. But there, the current plan is if the child dies, that's not where they want it. The parents and the child want it to go at that moment when they turn 18. So they'll put a will together to have what we call a power of appointment, so that at that point we specifically identify who it is that will be the beneficiaries at that given time, exercising that power when the child turns 18. Maybe when they're 25, that will change who the assets of the trust will go to, and will revise the will. So, but generally speaking, we're not recommending that children have wills at the time they're 18, only when they have some assets, and then we need to point you as the parents as the representatives. Okay. Your child is an adult. Should we appoint him or her as your representative if you're incapacitated under your power of attorney or your health care documents? It is the $64,000 question, and the struggle is, well, is your child demonstrating a level of maturity? And fortunately for you all, many of you, your children have done phenomenally all the way through, and once they're 18, they may, once 18, begin to participate in these decisions. We typically recommend that the child not officially qualify until they're 25, because some of these decisions are highly sensitive, making decisions about switching hospitals or a type of medical care or engaging in some kind of lawsuit or fighting the IRS on some kind of audit if you were incapacitated. When your child is just getting off the ground, finishing college, maybe going into graduate school, puts real pressure on them. So we build into our documents, not just when you all have children that are over 18, that that then they get included, and then at 25 they officially qualify. We have had many situations where children have been in their early teens, and we say if they're over the age of 25, so that at least we're building something in place today that we don't necessarily have to address again for maybe another 10 years. There may be other reasons why, because the medical laws or federal laws have changed on powers of attorney, or even though those are generally governed by state, but medical laws with respect to release of information or removal of life support. Point being that, yes, we recommend naming the child, but we name them as an alternate. Sometimes we'll say once the child is 25 that child jumps above everybody else. As well, but we have to have high confidence that child is already mature. Okay. Number five, your child is an adult. Should you make outright gifts to that child? What are the risks of giving this gift? So you know that there are multiple ways to make the gifts. You can make $13,000 annual exemption gifts from husband and wife or just a single parent or to a niece or nephew or a grandchild every year. Those kinds of gifts are nominal enough in our mind that they don't necessarily have to be in a trust. But if there's an aggregation of gifts over years, and there may be other gifts being given to the child where there's a trust in place, so many of you have put trust in place for your children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews, that make those gifts into the trust. Why not leave it in there where it's protected? So we are hugely focused on having some kind of protected vehicle. So I always give the example that if I want to create a trust to protect my assets, I can't effectively do that, at least not in the tri-state area. There are certain jurisdictions that give us some ability to do some kind of planning where I could put money into a trust and have it protected and still have access. It is largely limited. And it is fraught with many caveats. But if I create a trust for my son Matthew or my daughters, and they turn 18, we can have them named as a trustee. At 18, we don't do that. Normally, it's 25. They can serve as a co-trustee, where these assets are protected, where they can participate in the trust, and maybe at 25 or 30, that child. Can be the sole trustee. And I jokingly say that, you know, you create this trust, the difference is by having a beautiful Tiffany box, you know, land on your child's front doorstep, wrapped and ready to go, and that's the gift. Well, what if that beautiful Tiffany box showed up in a Humvee or a tank in front of your house, and in front of what was there were the keys for your child to serve as a co-pilot with another driver, and the Tiffany box is inside. So, yes, the child can direct where the tank is going and ultimately be the sole person driving that, but the assets inside it are protected. I cannot do that for myself, but I can give that gift to my children. And if they can serve as trustee exclusively once they reach a certain age, then there's no real reason to have the trust end. Keep the trust running for your child's lifetime. If they pass away at 30 and they're married and they have three children, the money will pass down to your grandchildren rather than getting diverted away to your child's spouse. And not that that's a bad thing, but when your child's spouse remarries, then those assets will be diverted rather than going down to the grandchildren. So for lifetime, you're also giving them asset protection. If they have a reversal in their life, if they have a car accident, if their private equity firm has failed, and there's personal liability, the money that you've left for your child in trust that they continue to enjoy and use, that they bought their beach house with or that they started a company with, inside that trust would be protected, and they would be largely the master of that ship. So we are big fans of always leaving the money in trust for the children. The child is 25, we're on number six. The child is 25 or younger and is getting married. Should we have them sign a prenuptial agreement? This is a tough point because it's a delicate time. We were all Romeo and Juliet at one point in our lives, or many of us, and we like to think that the world is perfect. The good news here is that as your estate lawyers, we have already contemplated this for your children. And so the assets going to your children will be in trust, and they will be protected. And so when our clients call us, when you all call us and say, my son's getting married and we're just a little nervous, there's a gap in economics net worth between us and them, and we're worried, is this all going to work out? We're hopeful. What can we do? The first thing we can tell you all is take comfort, because the money that you are leaving your child and that you've already transferred to your child is in a trust that's protecting them. It's not going to come out at the age of 30 or 35, because it's going to be in there for their lifetime. And so as long as the child is guided well, and there'll be more on that in a second, and the money stays in the trust, the child can take comfort that in a divorce or a car accident, that money would not be vulnerable. So there is less of a need to sign or prepare a prenuptial agreement. There is risks, though. We are giving your child the keys to the Humvee and or the tank, and at some point they're not a co-pilot, they're driving on their own. So they could open the door and take the Tiffany box and bring it outside, and that would not be the first time. What we tell them to do is to make all their acquisitions within the trust so that the trust owns these, the beach house and so forth. And if there's a divorce, or the primary house, if there's a divorce, then we know that those assets are protected. Or have the trust loan your child and their new spouse assets so that they can buy the house. The husband and wife both own it, but if there is a divorce, the first thing that gets paid back is the loan back to the trust, and it does not become a marital asset, the house. The house is a marital asset, but the first thing is the debt paid off. We are big fans of that. And so when we speak this way, there's less of a need to have a prenuptial. Where your risks are, or when your child decides to go rogue and say, you know what, I've decided to take half of it out of the trust. I'm 36. I've finally decided to get married. And, you know, my spouse has encouraged me to do this. They think it's too unwieldy to have it in the trust. And you know what? Then the answer is yes. You do have that risk. And we feel that that is a balance, because we want to give your child the opportunity to manage these assets and to have full control. And when they reach that certain age, we're hoping that they have been indoctrinated well enough as to the values and the virtues of having this trust that they won't take it out. But should they take it out, that is vulnerable, and that may be a reason right there to sign a prenuptial in the off chance that your trust that you prepared for your child many, many years earlier is now vulnerable. But in general, we've tried to tread lightly on the prenuptial agreements, because it can present delicate topics, and if it's not done appropriately and it's signed, you know, 30 days before the marriage and there's feeling that there was pressure to sign it and they didn't both have counsel and all the assets were not disclosed, there's a way to punch it through and you know, and argue its invalidity down the road. So when you're contemplating signing a prenuptial, give yourself enough advance time, let us know, and we'll point you to people who are extremely talented and take as seriously the business of doing prenuptials as we take our business of protecting you and your children in your estate planning. We're on to number 7, which is now your child is under 18. What risks do you have? Many years ago, you know, this has been always a concern. Mom and dad are going away on vacation the first time ever. Grandma and grandpa are watching the kids. Oh, what happens if little Amelia has got to go to the hospital? Well, what we do is, mom will sign a letter and say, this is Amelia's mom, and my mother and my father are hereby authorized to take that child to the hospital. So Amelia's 3, or she's 5, or she's 14, and she has an accident. We know if it's serious or not. We want to take prophylactic measures, and we want to be proactive here, so we have the child go to the hospital, and now grandma's there, or aunt is there, or neighbor is there, and the hospital says, who are you? I am the aunt. Okay, where are the parents? The parents are on St. John in the Caribbean, and they don't have cell phone coverage down there on their part of the island, and we can't reach them, and they've got 2 transfers to get back up here. There are no planes that land on St. John. They're coming back up here, but we need to get this child in. What's the matter with the child? They fell and banged their head. Or the child has had stomach pains for 24 hours. We want to make sure it's not an appendicitis or meningitis. The hospital says, we can't admit the child. What do you mean you can't admit the child? We can't admit the child because the parents are not here. Well, I'm here. Here's my handwritten note. Well, take your note and your story walking because we're not admitting the child. Well, aren't you here, hospital, to save lives? And the answer is from the hospital, of course we are. Okay, but we don't know whether this is a life and death situation. Well, when does that happen? Well, we'll only know after the child continues to decline. So you can sit here for the next 24 hours, or you can go home and post us and come back here. Well, what happens in the meantime? Well, the answer is we can do no more. To which this is the classic line. You know, do you know who my son is or my daughter is or that our law firm is McManus and Associates? You know, we have more resources than you have doctors. And the hospital says, exactly, and that's why we're not letting your child in here. We're not letting your child in here because if we reject your child and we have good basis for it, and right now we do because there's no verification that there's a serious medical issue, we will not get in trouble. But if we admit that child and that child turns out to get staph infection here or develop some kind of syndrome from the hospital or is emotionally impaired because of coming in here for the procedures that we have to do, and then the child turns out to be otherwise healthy, we get sued because we didn't have the authority to accept that child in here. So the way we get around this is have your child, as you all know, and you should recommend this to your family members, is whoever has small children, have those children named, have a health care proxy put together where the parents name a handful of people. One or two can be local, and others can be family members around the country. They should have that health care proxy should be readily available. I always jokingly refer you all and say, keep one set with me, make a copy, put one in the safe deposit box, and then the one that's most safe of all, you take to the inside of your kitchen cabinet door and you tell your babysitters and your support at the house that here is the documents. If you need it, call the lawyer and call our representatives. Go to the hospital, bring it with you, and then the representatives can call in, and hopefully one is close enough. Don't name the nanny or the babysitter because those people can swerve in and out of your lives as times change, but your family members and your dear friends will stay on. That's number one. Number two is now the child is admitted and the hospital says, does little Amelia have any medical conditions, any preconditions, any allergies? I don't know. It's my daughter's child. Well, let's call the primary care provider. And, of course, that's the local physician. And the local physician says, who are you? I'm the grandmother. I can't release the information to you because of HIPAA, which is the Federal Release of Medical Information. So now we have all of you, as you know, have your children have a release of medical information so that all of the representatives can request from their physicians their medical information if we're switching hospitals and so forth. And all this can happen and getting the medical information while you're still making your way back home. Even you may not even know what's going on in that respect. Okay? We're on to number nine. Your child is under 18 and you have selected guardians who reside overseas. What are the risks to getting them home? Because many of you, as you know, and we represent a large block of people who come from overseas or who have family members overseas, who have children that were born here, who have children that were born overseas but may go back home, there are a whole boatload of complications in this matter. In fact, because we are now involved with the Society of Trust and Estates Professional, which is an international organization, and we're also involved with the European American Chamber of Commerce. There is a lot of work that we're doing with internationals and coming here and where we're getting sought advice from us on how to handle these situations. It is a combination of working with Immigration and Naturalization Department, the State Department, our U.S. Embassy overseas, and the surrogates courts here. And nobody has the solution. And so it is wading through this and trying to make the most saleable, presentable, winnable argument as we're trying to get that child back home or to the guardians who are overseas. So classic example, British expats who are here on a corporate relocation for 5 years, Two children were born in London. One was born here. Mom and dad are living in the U.S. They named their grandparents, the grandparents back in London. Mom and dad sadly passed away. We're reminded of those kinds of tragedies with September 11th, 2 days ago. And how do we get those children overseas? Okay, so the first piece of import is make sure that the children's U.S. passports are current here. Secondly is, if that child has a connection overseas and there is some notion that that child may be going overseas, you may be returning overseas, or that if you passed away that there would be guardians overseas, consider getting the international passport for that country. If you don't choose to get that passport, then you want to also be mindful that if your child is brought overseas and they're a U.S. citizen, after 12 months typically, you have to have a visa. And that visa would have to be applied for by your child's guardians and also the child's local appointed guardians in the meantime. Now, guardians, what happens? First of all, New York will not allow your foreign guardians to be appointed and serving as sole guardians. So you have to have local U.S. guardians to serve as co's. It does not mean your child cannot go overseas, but you need to be mindful that you have to have co-guardians. For New Jersey, Connecticut, and Florida, key states that we represent many of you in, the foreign guardian can serve alone. But we do have to, they will look at what's in the best interest of the child, what the family history is, who is the best person to serve overseas. Okay, New Jersey will send the paperwork to the embassy or the consulate overseas. So if the grandparents or the family members are overseas, they can meet at the U.S. embassy, sign off on the paperwork acknowledging guardianship without having to make the trip over, particularly if there are economic reasons. But it is key that you have that access. Our wills always put together and say, name temporary guardians locally, because what we don't ever want to be in is a situation where mom and dad passed away, we have foreign guardians, they haven't qualified, they're still trying to get over here, and the next thing you know is that your children or your grandchildren or your friends and their loved ones are going into a group home or some kind of social services organization until these things can get organized. It is a highly stressful situation, and we want to have that piece done and done ahead of time. Temporary guardians are key. In New York, that temporary guardian can also be the co-guardian because, as you know, New York doesn't allow for sole one. Again, we want to have that visa put in place, which could mean requiring health screenings, background checks, and so forth. And I'm not necessarily recommending that you get the visa ahead of time. The easier thing to do is to have a passport for that country. But if you don't have the passport, that country will likely require a visa in order to stay in that country more than a year. You may also get some kind of grief when you get to the airport where you're at when you're at the TSA, which is the Transportation Security Association. They don't have any involvement in determining who should have custody. They don't, in fact, have any regulations that deal with whether that your parents can take their grandchild across the border. We've seen it happen when the immigration officers at Canada will look into the cars and say, are you all children? Is this your parents? Is this your name on the passport? To avoid human trafficking. What we recommend, and we've just been in this situation recently where both parents have passed away and the guardians wanted to take the children to Italy, not for permanently, but just for relief, and the guardians were U.S., easier set of facts. In that set of facts, what we had was a letter prepared saying that as guardians, we hereby authorize the children, because the children were going without the guardians, to travel with these folks. You also have to have that letter for the airlines. The airlines are far more focused on that than the TSA is, which is that group that checks your passport as you are going through the U.S. You also want to be ready that you have that valid passport at that time for the child, and that if you intend to stay overseas, that you need to move quickly, your child needs to move quickly to get their visa in place if they're there more than a year. If that child is a green card holder, we have a separate set of facts. So they're coming from England, and the child is a green card holder with their parents. They're not born in the U.S. If they go overseas, but they want to come back to the U.S., in order to assure that they can come back and forth into the U.S., it may be easy to get back to England because they're a U.S. passport holder. I mean, they're an English passport holder. But suppose they want to protect their green card status. After a year, they have to renew. If they don't renew within 2 years, they lose that opportunity. So we always have to be respectful, and we'll always give your guardians advice to say protect that child's access to the U.S. So passports for children is number 10. We have talked about that piece to some degree. Keep in mind the dual passport and the foreign nationality. Be mindful that you want to keep those current because that will speed the process of moving over. Seas, be mindful if you don't have a U.S. passport, your children, that and only a green card, that we want to get back into the U.S., you need to renew after 12 months, and you have until 24 months before you lose that opportunity. So a very quick review. We started at 12:03. It's 12:34. We're just at about a half an hour. What we have determined that we're going to do going forward here is we're going to issue a press release just for all of you who have children, your expats, and you're coming from overseas. Today was about minor children turning 18, minor children who are not yet 18, advice for that, but and then finishing up on children who are foreign and then maybe going overseas. That piece will issue a press release. Great to have you all on the call. Look forward to speaking with you next week. Next month. And then the final thing is please do not lose sight of the fact that we've got less than 90 days or just over 90 days before this $5 million gifting exemption evaporates. So we're doing a lot of work in this area. We've had many of you have done it in the first 6 months of last year, but some of you have said, I've got some new ideas. Come to us because we're extremely busy at this point, and we want to help those of you wrap up any further gifting that you want to do before year end. All the best for a great fall. See you in a month.
Thank you. Please stand by.